You are listening to a podcast of Ice and Fire, episode 120 for the week of September 22nd, 2013. Welcome back, everybody, to the longest-running, award-winning podcast dedicated to George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire series and occasionally HBO's Game of Thrones. Today we're having a special episode dedicated to A Flight of Sorrows, the collector's edition, and I'm joined by two special guests.
I'm Alex Smith, co-founder of Tower of the Hand. As always, it's a pleasure to be on a podcast of Ice and Fire.
And I'm Mark Kleinhans. I'm the editor of A Flight of Sorrows.
Cool. Good to have you here, both of you. And well, we're going to start off with some details on what exactly the collector's edition is and some information about it. Mark, can you tell us about it?
Well, I'm still making it, so God knows what's going to be in it. It's first and foremost, it's a print edition of everything that we had in the ebook edition. So it's all 13 chapters, including the appendices and the foreword and afterword, all that fun stuff. And then we're doing an additional, it's going to be about 7 chapters or so. That's 4 full-length essays, got a brand new introduction and a new foreword and a new afterword. Maybe a surprise as well. We'll have to see how things shape up at the last possible minute.
When is it available and how do people get it?
Available October 1st. It'll be out for 1 month only. We're going through CreateSpace. And actually, you can go to Amazon. You can buy it that way, just like you would with any other book or with the ebook edition of Flight of Sorrows. But we would really greatly appreciate it if you could do the CreateSpace store that we're going to set up, since the CreateSpace store will have the same price to you, the consumer, but we actually get a little bit more of a slice of the action ourselves that way. Amazon's not quite as greedy that way, so we'd appreciate it if you could possibly check it out if you're interested in it through the CreateSpace store.
It might not seem like much, but it may be the difference between our children starving or not. So just keep that in mind when you're choosing your venue.
I have one now. He just turned 1 year old, so he'd appreciate it.
Just keep that in mind.
I'll have the links up on our website on October 1st when it's released, but they're both, I guess, really associated with Amazon, or just one of them?
The CreateSpace is a separate site from Amazon, but it's owned and operated by them. So it'll be a createspace.com URL.
All right, we'll have those up. Did you want to reveal who's doing the afterword?
Yeah, the afterword's some crazy guy. His name is Kyle. I think he's homeless, and you have him on occasionally.
Yeah, we bring him on for occasional shows. We pay him by the hour. But
he's the guy who won the award, right?
Oh, we just sent him to pick it up for us. Like, he lives close.
Oh, right. So. I see.
No, but he gave a good speech there. That's good. So this edition will have like things from me, Mimi, and Kyle. So just Ashley is the only one who is maybe that's the surprise part, but no, probably not.
I'm working right now with a whole bunch of different possible people for the next ebook, which is called Hymn for Spring. So I think Ashley, she might see me circling like a vulture sometime soon.
Cool. All right. So what we're going to do today is we're going to cover Alex's essay In a Flight of Sorrows, which is available both in the collector's edition. And like, if let's say you listen to this past that month, you can still buy the ebook to get access to it. And then we're going to talk about my essay, which is in the collector's edition only. So, Alex, why don't you give us the title of your essay and a quick summary of it?
Sure, absolutely. So the essay I did, and just to clarify, this is not a new essay for the collector's edition. This is the one in the original ebook. But there will be a rebuttal piece to my essay in the new collector's edition, brand new rebuttal. And that's why it is apropos to talk about this one right now as the collector's edition begins to launch. So my essay was called The Prince That Illyrio Promised, kind of a play on the whole Prince That Was Promised name, because it's about Aegon and how he may not be who he seems to be, this being, you know, the son of Rhaegar, who was revealed in A Dance with Dragons to still be alive. And I'm really not convinced that he is actually Aegon, and so I explore that in some detail in this essay.
Alex, I wanted to ask you, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You really honestly are convinced, is that him, or is that just a stance you took for the book?
No. This is actually, I'm not playing devil's advocate. My theory is actually one that I believe has a decent chance of being true. Now, obviously, as with any theory, I mean, I do have to make some leaps. It's not based entirely on what's been revealed so far in the text. But yeah, no, I do believe that he is not actually Aegon Targaryen.
Here's a question for you. Like, before A Dance with Dragons came out, did you even think about Aegon, or were you one of the people that actually thought about him?
thought about whether he might still be living, you mean, before he was revealed to be alive? No, I really hadn't given it too much thought. You know, but one thing, you know, and I do talk about this a lot in the essay, one thing that I did think a lot about was I never thought that the original Illyrio Varys Viserys plan in A Game of Thrones made a lot of sense. I always thought it seemed a little simplistic, a little bit, well, it's just a bad idea to have a barbarian horde turned loose on a kingdom that you plan to rule once you, you know, have 10,000 Dothraki rape and pillage and murder all across it. And so, you know, that's once the whole Aegon thing was revealed, that aspect started to make a lot more sense to me because I now don't think it was a plan that was ever meant to succeed.
First, I want to just say, and I think Mark will agree with me, your essay is just a joy to read. Like, it's just nice reading, like, the language and just, like, the way you write it. It's fun, right?
Thank you very much.
And then second, in relation to what you said, because even before, I didn't think about Aegon either because there wasn't really that much said beyond, like, Cryptic Comics by George before the fifth book. But it didn't make sense that, from what we've heard, I mean, this is kind of through hearsay, we heard from, through Stannis, what Barristan said, but, like, that Varys was bringing down one of the reasons why the Targaryens went down in the first place, and then now they're bringing them back. That never really made sense to me until we could get some of these kind of theories to explain why that would happen, right?
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, I really wondered, you know, what Illyrio's angle could be in all this, because, again, that's something that didn't seem to make much sense. I mean, we've had several people comment on either Illyrio specifically or on Free Cities merchants just generally, you know, including, you know, both Tywin and Tyrion, who I think overall are very shrewd judges of character. And, you know, then Daenerys, who, you know, was commenting in the first book. So at 13, maybe she wasn't a shrewd judge of character yet, but at least had spent a lot of time around him. And they all seem to be of the opinion that he's a guy that's just going to sell out anybody for anything. I mean, he's not the kind of guy that seems to, you know, make friends with exiles to a throne just to put them on that throne and get what? I mean, he's already got the riches. There's not much more that Westeros can offer him in that way. And titles, it really doesn't seem to be something that Free Cities merchants are after. Castles in Westeros, titles in Westeros. I mean, it seems like everyone in Essos essentially sees the Westerosi as barbarians. I mean, it's kind of beneath their notice for that kind of thing. And so the combination of, you know, why would he want to back a Targaryen to begin with? And then B, why, when he decided to back a Targaryen, would he make such a ridiculous and, in my opinion, plan to bring Dothraki over to do that conquest, led me to start wondering if there wasn't something more going on there. And which is what led me to this theory that Aegon is actually Illyrio's son by his second wife.
Did he put aside his first wife, or did his first wife die and then he got a second wife? Do we know about that?
I believe his first wife died. I don't believe he set her aside. How I would have to look to be sure. However, he did create quite a controversy when he married his second wife because she was, a prostitute, essentially, from Lys. The books do not come out and say that she was a slave, but our understanding generally is that these pleasure house workers in Lys are all slaves. So I imagine she was, even though the text hasn't come out and said that. And we do know, you know, there was this line in the book where he mentioned that, you know, the prince's palace was forever closed to him the moment he made that marriage. So there were political repercussions. Obviously, he is still a magister of the city, which are the rulers of Pentos. So he didn't lose all of his political clout, but he certainly made enemies amongst the members of high society in Pentos.
How familiar are you guys with the Matrix trilogy?
The first one was good and the other one sucked.
Have you seen them, Alex?
Yeah, I've seen them. I kind of feel the same way about them, but yeah.
There's this quote from Matrix Reloaded that I was so tempted to insert somewhere, very feebly probably in your essay. where you have the Merovingian, and Neo asks, you know, why is he doing this? Why is he doing his silly little stuff? And the Oracle says, well, what do men with power want? More power. There's no necessarily rationale or explanation for it. It becomes like a cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So I always kind of assume that's how Illyrio was, whether or not this is really his son.
Yeah, well, you know, I get the sense that it's more with, and of course this is, you know, taking some leaps again, but with people in the free cities, it seems to be more that, you know, they're people with money, and what do people want that have money? More money. I mean, it doesn't seem like power is quite as important. And this just comes from, you know, some of the observations of the Westerosi, and obviously, you know, the people of Westeros are going to be biased. I mean, there's clearly a very big cultural difference between Westeros and Essos, and definitely people on both sides there say a lot of disparaging things about the people on the other. So we can't take statements from people like Tywin, you know, completely at face value. But it doesn't seem like power is something that's very interesting to them, and certainly Tyrion does not sound convinced when Illyrio says, well, yeah, you know, I'll be master of coin and I'm going to have a castle someplace and it'll be great. And Tyrion's like, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So, you know, I get what you're saying. And that's, I mean, that is very much a possibility because you do have to make some leaps here. But I think Illyrio is not the type that would really be interested in political power in the barbarian West.
Yeah, I think you have to put the rest of Alex's points together, because if it was just this point that, like, why is he doing it, it wouldn't be enough. But if you sum it up with the other points we're going to go through, then it kind of comes together and would explain why he'd do it. Okay, but here's a question for you. Like, when he gives Dany the three eggs, he never expected them to hatch, right? He wouldn't have given it to her, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, magic of that kind had been gone from the world for so long. I don't think he expected those eggs to hatch. I mean, he specifically says to Tyrion that he expected Daenerys to die in the Dothraki Sea. And we know, of course, that he tried to convince Viserys to stay behind. And so basically, he was sending those dragon eggs out to the Dothraki Sea, expecting their caretaker to die and there to be no Targaryens left out there to do any crazy dragon stuff. So, I mean, that definitely doesn't seem like he was motivated by prophecy or by a belief in magic or a belief that those Targaryen eggs would actually hatch.
One thing you highlighted a lot was the connection that Illyrio seems to have with this Aegon, just the way he cares for him and that sort of thing.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, this is one of the points that can go either way, because certainly young Aegon was raised in Illyrio's household. I mean, it's not strictly necessary for you to be the biological parent to have a fondness for a child that you raised, you know, from an infant. But it does seem kind of out of character with Illyrio. I mean, he's a man that, you know, everyone says would sell his closest friends to the highest bidder. He seems far more interested in wealth than he does in alliances, but he does have a romantic side for his second wife. I mean, he gave up a lot of political clout in the city in order to make that marriage. I mean, when he says it was for love, I actually believe him in this case. And, you know, he saved the hands too, which is kind of creepy, but, you know, yeah. I guess that's romantic and in a society as brutal as that one. I mean, there's certainly far worse things you can do. And so, you know, he loved his wife so much. And so it would make sense to me that even though this is a man who doesn't have much compassion for most people, that if he had had a child with her, then I think that's a child that he would care for very much. And he certainly shows the fondness. I mean, bringing a bag of his favorite sweets along as he escorts Tyrion to the river, to the Roin, and I mean, Tyrion says he genuinely looks crushed that he won't be able to see Aegon because they have to, you know, head off too quickly. And so I find it hard to believe that merely having him in the house when he was an infant would be enough to create that connection. I think that biological parent connection would make sense. And you know, that's kind of— so then, and this is one of the bigger leaps I'm forced to take, but I think it's a valid one. You know, we know the marriage wasn't popular amongst the powerful because of this quote about the prince's palace being forever closed. And it would make sense to me then, and of course there's no textual evidence, but it makes sense to me then that his son, by this pleasure house girl, who is most likely a slave or started life as a slave, would be very frowned upon. And that would be a child that would be shunned and scorned by a lot of Pentashi society and the free cities in general. All of the free cities, with the exception, of course, of Braavos, have the same strong view of slavery. In fact, Pentos is benign by comparison to a place like Volantis, where, you know, once a slave, always a slave, no matter what. Mm. And so in my mind, the reason why he might turn to Westeros, a place that people in the free cities normally don't care about, is because he doesn't see a place for his son by a slave girl in the free cities, and so he has to go to the barbarian West to find a place for that son to prosper.
You know, Alex, I have to tell you, when I first read Dance with Dragons, I did think that Aegon was a pretender. And then after thinking about it and going, personally, for me, the key moment is at the end of Clash of Kings, when Dany sees that vision of Rhaegar, and he says that the dragon has three heads, and he's talking about his son being one of them. So that, as flimsy as it may sound as of right now, that to me, I think, I've gone back and I've changed my mind. I think he is the real deal. But I found your essay completely compelling and very intriguing. And the one thing that really made the light bulb go off over my head was the whole thing about how exactly would Dothraki take over Westeros for this series? How would that work? How really does that make sense? And it's like, yeah, George, how does it make sense?
Yeah, exactly. And even if they could take it, I mean, let's say for the sake of argument that they get the absolute best scenario, which is that Robert cannot be held back by his more cautious commanders like Tywin or Eddard, and takes everybody out in the field and meets them in open combat and gets slaughtered, which, I mean, I think is something that could certainly happen. I mean, if you look at the historical parallels with the Mongol invasions of the West, I mean, in places like Hungary, that's kind of what happened. I mean, they you know, the knights all came out and met them on the field, and they were just slaughtered because, you know, the fast-moving hit-and-run tactics of the Mongol hordes were so superior. Now, of course, the real Mongol hordes, unlike the Dothraki, actually had very sophisticated siege train, very sophisticated siege craft. So, I mean, Genghis Khan, or Genghis's forces, rather, he wasn't there personally, could have certainly besieged and taken castles across Western Europe if they hadn't been called back when they were, whereas the Dothraki have no stomach for siege craft, and you know, the castles would provide a huge obstacle. But let's say for the sake of argument that, you know, the armies are slaughtered in the field, and then the castles do give up just because of all the raping and pillaging and burning going on around them. Great, you've just won Westeros with the Dothraki horde, and now you want to be their king. How are they going to feel about that in Westeros? I mean, you would have to keep the Dothraki horde there, I would think, to maintain your power base. And they're not going to stay. I mean, you know, they see this as a gift exchange. It's like, okay, you gave me a hot wife, I'm going to give you a nice crown, and then we're going to go our separate ways. I mean, they don't really want to settle in Westeros. And so, you know, the Dothraki leave, you know, he's left with the Golden Company, maybe. But I would think even Dorne would be hard-pressed to support a Targaryen restoration that hinged upon Dothraki burning everything. Mm. And so I just don't see how he could hold the throne after doing that. You know, Aegon the Conqueror was able to hold the throne after coming over with a skeleton force, but he had dragons. I mean, that just completely changes the dynamic. And Viserys was not going to have dragons because, as I said before, I don't think there's any way that Illyrio thought that dragons were going to be added to this mix. So, yeah, I mean, it's just a battle plan that seemed like it wouldn't make sense. But as a distraction, while preparing the real Targaryen, it makes a whole lot more sense in my mind.
Because he would come back, as you say, he would come back as like a liberator rather than a conqueror, like to help deal with these foreign invaders.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, the exact form that, that the invasion might have taken, I mean, who knows? I mean, it could be that, that they were going to have the Dothraki invade and then have Aegon come and save the day, which is something I postulate in the essay. It could be that they just wanted to use the threat of a Dothraki invasion to make Aegon look like a better choice as a new Targaryen leader. Or it could have been just a complete distraction, being like, hey, look at this army building up over here while, you know, actually the real army's building up over here with Aegon. But, I mean, certainly there was going to be some coordination because the Golden Company thought that they were going to be working with a Dothraki horde because the leader of the company mentions that at one point when he's on screen or on the page. But yeah, just invading with Dothraki never made sense to me. And so when we got this kind of alternate take, you know, on Aegon being the real Targaryen that Illyria wanted on the throne rather than Viserys, I mean, that kind of, that's what got the whole wheels turning on some of these things.
Well, as Mark mentioned, Mark still believes Aegon is the real deal. That's one of the key points for us to separate is, like, do you believe Aegon is a pretender or the real deal? A lot of people think he's pretenders, and then various theories, including yours, have come up to fill that void. Another idea that's been there is Aegon having some connection to the Blackfyres. Do you think that can be related at all to your theory through his mother, or it's not, your theory isn't dependent on it, but do you think it'd be compatible at all?
I the theories would be compatible. I personally think that's a bridge too far for me, which is why I was aware of those theories when I wrote the essay. I didn't really want to go there because it's a few more coincidences than I like, which isn't to say it can't be true because there's nothing to disprove it yet either. But it just so happens that Illyrio falls in love with a girl in the pleasure house that just so happened to be a female Blackfyre. It seems kind of odd that they'd lose track. I mean, I understand that, you know, Martin has never said that the female line was extinguished. He's only said that the male line was extinguished. But it's hard to believe that there would be a Blackfyre that knows she's a Blackfyre, but that the rest of the world or that the Westerosi have lost track of. I mean, certainly there are going to be people with Blackfyre blood in their veins, you know, running around for generations that have no idea that they were descended from this once great, you know, royal lineage. But it's hard to believe. I mean, the last Blackfyre male died in living memory of the series. And so it seems kind of early for someone to have completely lost track of this Blackfyre thread that then became a slave, unless it was, you know, illegitimate Blackfyres, which would be kind of ironic since, you know, they're illegitimate. But that just seems too many dots to have to connect. And then, you know, there's some people that add another wrinkle to that, which is that maybe Varys was also a Blackfyre. And so that's why he's working with Illyrio to conspire to put Blackfyres back on the throne. And again, especially since the male line is supposed to be extinguished, that seems like way too many leaps of logic for me. It would be an interesting wrinkle, but I don't personally see it. But I readily admit that there is nothing to disprove it either. And it has an equal chance of being valid as my theory. I'm not trying to say that my theory is based on more sound evidence, because I have to certainly have to make some leaps to get to my conclusion as well.
Well, personally, I think that the whole idea, all the theories before Dance with Dragons came out that maybe Aegon was switched out and he's still alive out there somewhere hovering, waiting to come back. I would read those things. I'd be like, oh my God, are you fucking kidding me?
Exactly. No. I mean, that's very true. And I mean, I briefly mentioned that in my essay. I mean, my theory is a crackpot theory. But, you know, the theory that Aegon was even alive at all was considered a crackpot theory.
Definitely.
Before he did end up being alive. So, you know, Martin does like to play with expectations. Martin does like to bury things that seem insignificant and then all of a sudden come out and become the center of attention. So, you know, I just want to say, you know, while I don't personally believe in these Blackfyre theories, they do have equal validity with my own and could very well end up being true.
What's so cool about Aegon, whether or not he really is Aegon, the fact that he's placed at the very end of, you know, books 4 and 5, of course, constitute act 2 of this overall 3-act structure. That's the Song of Ice and Fire. And mm-hmm. by placing it at the very end of act 2, he now opens up this possibility of anything that you've thought before, any crackpot theory, anything that you thought was real or valid. Everything's on the table now. Everything's questionable. Anything can happen in the last 2 books in the 3rd act. And for my money, again, I do think Aegon is the real guy, but whether or not he is, just the narrative function that he serves, that he calls everything else into question, I think is really exciting and gives a whole bunch of extra momentum going into the last 2 books.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an incredible game changer. I mean, all along we thought we knew how the Targaryen aspect of this was going to play out. Daenerys was going to do her thing in the east, gather allies, whatever, and then come west, and she would be the one to invade Westeros, and she would rally people around the Targaryen banner. And now, you know, she's not the first Targaryen to land in Westeros, and it creates a completely new dynamic, like you said, that is certainly interesting.
I kind of mentioned this earlier, but I guess I want to ask more explicitly. Like, did you think that Illyrio and Varys actively brought down the Targaryens, or they just took advantage of the Targaryens going down?
Yeah, here's an area where it's certainly a little more murky, because we don't know very much about what Varys was doing during that time period, and most of it comes from people like Barristan, who have a natural disdain for the sneaky spy master, hide in the shadows kind of guy. And so, you know, it's hard to take that prejudice out of their statements. Right now, I am assuming that it was a target of opportunity rather than an active takedown. But that's largely because I don't feel there's enough evidence to state the other position. All you really have to go on is, you know, Barristan's statements that Varys was always quick to, you know, find new traitors, you know, to feed the Mad King's paranoia. And then on the other side, you know, you have, you know, Pycelle's statement. I think it was Pycelle's statement that it was somebody's statement, maybe Jaime's. I think it was actually Jaime's saying that, you know, while Pycelle was really counseling that he opened the gates, Varys was counseling, you know, don't be stupid. Don't do that. So, you know, there's a little bit on both sides of that, but there's so little on either side that I just assumed for the purpose of my essay that it was a target of opportunity, just for lack of evidence as much as anything. Lack of evidence either way.
Yeah, we don't know the timelines very well either. And like if his son would have been even born by then, or if he was planning for a son that was coming, or all of that.
Yeah, I mean, the timeline is certainly very murky on Illyrio and Varys. You know, he had 2 wives, we know that, but we don't think we have too much timeline of when events occurred in their rise. We just kind of have a general narrative of what was going on.
I was going to open up a whole other can of worms by saying, I bet you, George being George, he's going to, again, complicate things, because he just loves to complicate and then further complicate and then complicate the complications. So I think he's going to say that he's going to reveal in the last 2 books that Varys actually is working against Illyrio. Varys has his own type of counter plan going on within the counter plan. So maybe Illyrio wanted to have the Mad King be overthrown for one reason or another, but Varys turns out that he wanted to save him just to, I don't know, be Varys, I guess. But again, that's just a crackpot theory. So
yeah, no, I mean, it's certainly possible. I mean, one thing that's for certain is that in this world of seemingly constant betrayals, Varys and Illyrio, who are 2 of the sneakiest son of a bitches in the whole thing, have had a personal alliance for a very long time. And that does seem to be unusual in this world. So you could very well be right.
And how did they, their whole thing, wasn't there their whole thing where they would steal things and sell it back at like a higher price? Wasn't that I think that was the way they kind of built up a fortune. And that, yes, that fits, like, that they steal the king, like they bring down the kingdom, then sell it back as a higher price to the so like that would fit that, be like one massive application of that con job. So
yeah, I mean, that's very true as well. I mean, that could fit their MO. That's something I hadn't considered, but it's a very good point.
It is.
Cool. Well, that's all I have to say. Do you have anything else to say on the Alex's essay here? Or?
As an editor,
well, I mean,
try
you know,
to...
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Please.
That's fine.
No, no. Oh, Okay. Yeah. Sorry. I was just going to say, you know, we've talked over a lot of the theory here. You know, there are a few more pieces of the theory as well. You know, there are several elements to it that if you take them in isolation, it's like, okay, maybe, but whatever. But I think that when you put them all together, that there is a compelling case to be made. And so even if this discussion doesn't completely convince you, I mean, I would urge you to read the full essay, which goes into a couple other points as well and tries to connect all of these dots.
Well, you have you had some good things on the historical potential parallels and things like that. So I was just going to say, like, keep reading so you can.
Yep. Exactly. Because you don't want to give everything away in the podcast, obviously. But
I think it is a very good read, in all honesty. And the reason I wanted to include it as the editor is I wanted something, regardless of how factual it may or may not be, something that really gets you to reinterpret everything that you may have already interpreted one way. So it's definitely, I keep using the word compelling, but I definitely think it is a compelling invitation to reinvestigate the entire series.
So now we're going to talk about my new essay that I wrote for the collector's edition called A Feast of Vipers. Subtitle: Ethnic Diversity, Personal Identification, and Fandom Theories in Dorne. And I've been wanting to write in Dorne for a while. Like I wrote a bit on them in my previous essay, but this collector's edition gave me the chance to just sit down and think about Dorne and how they were brought into this series, how they were foreshadowed and brought into the series, what role they've played so far, where they've gone. So I've kind of looked at it in a two way. Like the way I describe my essay, I look at the past history of Dorne and how they came over, like they have the invasions, they resist the Targaryens, and then what they're doing now, and try to draw parallels there. And then I looked at the actual characters that we've seen so far, specifically the Martell family, and how some members like Oberyn have been really accepted by the fandom, and others like Quentyn almost rejected by the fandom, or they were disappointed in him. And then at the end, like I wrote this work before the whole Red Viper casting controversy happened, so I went back and I wrote like an epilogue to kind of talk about the issues that came up there and my view there. So I really enjoyed having the opportunity to write this thing.
But for me, when you pitched me on the idea, I'm like, yeah, okay, that sounds okay. And I wasn't that, to be honest with you, no offense, I wasn't that intrigued by it like I was right off the bat by Alex's essay. But as I read it, I realized that I never really paid much attention to Dorne, first of all, and that you were calling my attention to all these different specific details. And yeah, that country or that region or that kingdom really is intriguing. And then towards the end, especially at the epilogue, as you get into this, the whole thing of personal identification and stereotypes and lack of stereotypes and what you expect and turning stereotypes on their heads, that it really, I thought it was a really strong essay and a really good one. And I'm very happy that you kicked it over.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, As you both kind of alluded to, it ended up being incredibly prescient that you decided to write it, because there is now a massive debate that has gone on across all of the major Song of Ice and Fire websites about Dorne and about ethnicity, racial identification in regards to this casting in the television show. And so, I mean, I think it's a very timely read for that reason. So, you know, a question for you would be where, you know, with this whole racial identification thing in Dorne, how did you personally picture the kind of Dornish look in your own head?
Well, in my own head, I saw the North African, Middle Eastern kind of look. But I saw that within the canon, like it was from India to Southern Europe, like any of those could fit. But in my head, at least some of them fit that. And that was in alignment with a lot of the art that I saw that was officially produced by Fantasy Flight Games. And just some of like the descriptions of the clothing and things like that, like fit those areas.
Yeah, the TV show definitely has a tendency to kind of homogenize everything, definitely. All the color, visually speaking, the color of the costumes, the color of the sets, the color of skin, all tends to kind of be drained out and very kind of non-controversial, very vanilla, for lack of a better word. And it does work, but I personally question it, because I think the showrunners say it's more realistic that way. But if you look back at the medieval time period, like look at what's the army of the Vatican? Is it called the Swiss Guard? I forget.
Yeah, the Swiss Guard, yes.
I mean, supposedly there were those costumes, or uniforms, excuse me, were designed by Da Vinci. And those things are as colorful and as silly as you could possibly imagine. And that was the fashion sense back in medieval period. So whenever we see these people from Essos or from other regions of Westeros, and they are drained of dyed hair or dyed beards, and they don't have all the different, like even the ships don't have the stripes on them. It's, to me personally, it's just disappointing creatively.
Even before the whole casting happened, in the way I wrote the thing, I said, within canon, you could do anything from South European, which is what they did, to Indian. So anything would fit. I just said this wasn't a chance where they could like cast from that whole range and it would be okay. Mm-hmm. Like they could have one person from Spain, one person from North Africa, one person from India, and kind of stretch it, and it would actually fit, rather than be like, oh, they're pandering or changing what was in canon. So that's what I said. So I'm not saying like, oh, when the guy came out, I wasn't like, oh, why did they cast him? He doesn't fit. He fit there. I'm just saying hopefully they would cast along the range. And with the second casting they've done with who was the cast now, like Oberyn's Paramore, like they went more along the other range, so it shows like maybe they are going to go along the range there, right?
Yes, exactly. I certainly hope so. I mean, you know, I always kind of envisioned the people to be kind of Southern European, and I mean way Southern. I mean when you get down far enough in Southern Italy, pretty dark skinned person, with the kind of cultural Moors blended in. That was no pun intended. I don't mean Moors as in the people, yeah. Moors, but with kind of the cultural sensibilities of North Africa, you know, with some of that Moroccan influence is kind of how I saw it fitting together. So, I mean, for me, the guy they cast fits just fine, but I understand where other people are coming from as well, who thought that maybe they should be a little darker. You know, I mean, as you point out in your essay, I mean, they certainly are described as dark. The Salty and the Sandy are described as dark in the book. But since that's a description that's coming from a very pale Westerosi person, I think that you have to also take into account the culture of the narrator who is calling them dark. So, I mean, they can be not quite as dark as a black person or an Indian person and still be considered dark to somebody who is as pale and fair haired as a Lannister is.
Let me ask you a question. I mean, given how geographically and culturally and blah, blah, blah diverse that Dorne is, do you think that type of diversity is going to pay off somehow in the last two books?
I didn't think about that question.
Do you think it's going to somehow influence how the Martells or the rest of the houses, how the stations end up keeping? Or do you think it's going to just be one of those things where, yeah, I'm George Martin and I want to slightly investigate this little area for a little while, but by the end of the story, I have to get back on track, and back on track means Winterfell and King's Landing.
Okay, well, yeah, well, I guess what I kind of talk about in the essay is Dorne is surprisingly unified given how diverse it is. And my idea was maybe because of continual external threats, it's what helped give this kind of unified identity, because you still there's a lot of diversity there. And so there's a different religion there still, but we don't have the conflict that's happened elsewhere, partly because they haven't been fighting. So they haven't gone, you know, hardened along religious lines. You still have like the Orphans of the Green Blood, and you have these different people there. So it's for a diverse area, it's surprisingly unified. So I guess like the thing could be like if Dany and Aegon both come over, and is Dorne going to split along different lines? Is it going to split along Martell and Ironwood lines? Or is it going to stay together? And I think if it splits, it's not going to really be because of the difference there, because it seems, despite having different people there, that doesn't seem to be a factor. And I kind of described that when I look at the Ironwood. Like, we don't know a lot about the Ironwood Martell thing, but it doesn't seem to be just the fact that they're, like, from different backgrounds. It just seems like the Ironwoods were kings before, and it's more that traditional role as being kings that was the striking factor. And they were, like, and the recent, like, antagonism from Oberyn's youthful dalliances that cause trouble, not like because Ironwoods are like lighter or something, or they had some sort of racial thing. That doesn't seem to be a problem in Dorne, so that won't be like a factor in the next few books.
Okay.
And you know, obviously, I mean, I think Dorne is a place that has had a lot of allure for a lot of people. I think, you know, the casting controversy is an excellent example of that. So what do you think it is about Dorne that just draws so many people in a way that other regions of Westeros don't?
A couple reasons which I go into. I mean, one is just the way like they're more like sexually relaxed and more liberal makes it easier to read. I mean, like, for some people, it's very hard to read the books with like the things that happen to women and people in the books. And Doran seems to be in some ways closer to our culture. So for some people, it's easier to read. But I also just made the analogy of it's just like the spice in the story. There's a lot, it's interesting characters, there's interesting stuff going on there. And it adds a certain spice there to what is otherwise a more unified continent. Even though you had like the North different from the Andals, there's nothing like the difference like with the Rhoynish customs of how like you have bending of Andal traditions with the Kingsguard. They actually have paramours down there, or you have female rulers ruling there. It makes it easier for people to read and more interesting sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely.
And this is something that's not explicitly covered in the essay, but since you are very keen on Dorne's importance, you know, there's been a lot of debate at places like Winter is Coming about how much Dorne we're actually going to get in the television series. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are, since you've given a lot of thought to how important Dorne is going to be in the end game. Do you think that the television producers are going to see this as a place where there are too many extra characters that are tangential to the story, and so they can just chop, chop, chop? Or do you think they're going to have to do some significant casting down there because it's just too important an area to ignore?
I think they could cut down on and they probably will, on the number of sand snakes, for example. They could combine them or cut down certain characters. But I think that they won't cut too deeply, because just from the fact that they have been putting place markers in, they keep making mentions of Dorne, like ships going to Dorne or Dornish girls, or like they've been putting references to Dorne. So I think they will go there. And I think the story will demand it, just from the fact of one, like in terms of the books themselves, like they have the full fighting force there. Yes, they have a smaller population, but they haven't been involved in any combat yet. And second, it seems like Dorne is heading on that way with Aegon, like kind of linking with what you're saying, like especially with what Dany's done and like Quentin being dead, I think they're going to throw their lot with Aegon. And so if Aegon's going to be in the TV show, he's going to need forces like Dorne to be there, and they're going to have an effect. So I don't think they're going to cut it too much. And especially, I think a lot of it will depend on how Oberyn is appreciated by the fandom. And I think that, as we predict, he'll be a popular character, and so people will want to see more of Dorne after they see Oberyn. So I think that it'll still play a big role. Like, they might cut a little bit with the whole Arianne story or like summarize it or some sort of thing, but I think Dorne itself is going to be big, and it's going to play an important part in the series.
I think it's going to be cut.
I think if they cut anything, it's going to be the Ironborn, because those are the two like things we got a big view in the early Feast for Crows. But like, we have Yara heading over to the east, apparently, or around, but we don't know. Maybe that'll just be canceled last second. They'll be like, "Oh, your father died. Never mind."
Yeah, that seems like it's about to go way off book there. Yeah. I mean, I've said in other venues, I mean, not to get too far into this since we're focusing on Dorne, I've said in other venues that I really think Victarion and Euron will end up being combined into one character, and that. Yeah, no, I mean, look, I know from a book reader point of view, they're completely different personalities. They have completely different roles in the story. I mean, I understand that. But, you know, just kind of how the same way that they made Thoros a composite for, you know, multiple Brotherhood Without Banner characters, I can see them saying, well, we only need one Greyjoy who can show up, usurp the throne, and then run off to try to bring Dany back. I mean, I can see them doing that for expediency.
Well, the bottom line is the cast and crew of Game of Thrones has a 6-year contract. And of course, you can always add on to that contract, or at least try to. But the showrunners have said they're very reluctant to try and draw that out too much longer. I definitely see them going at least 7 seasons. But if they were to be as faithful to the future books as they have been to the past books, you were looking at probably a 10 or 11 season show. And the fact that they're going to try to cut down to 6 or 7 seasons, I think basically books 4 and 5 will basically all be gutted.
Yeah, I agree. Gutted and rearranged. I mean, I think we'll probably get all the most important plot beats from those books, but we're not going to get the travelogues. We're not going to get you know, Brienne running all over the place.
No, definitely
Tyrion
not.
Taking so long to go down the Rhoyne. I think it's going to be condensed. And quite frankly, I think you'd have to for television. I mean, I like both of those books very much. I think especially now that you can read them combined, you know, mixing the chapters together, that they are fascinating books and read very well. But the television show needs a forward momentum that material just does not provide. And so they're going to have to condense, rearrange, and cut to make compelling television.
Cool. I have one comment from Stefan here, if you want to go to that, about the essay, or just sure. About Dorne in general, so because he couldn't make it and he was sick. But he said to him, like, and actually I'm not surprised that he said this, he doesn't really admire Dorne or think it's badass because he doesn't like the lust for revenge that everybody has over there that's going to cause trouble. And Dorne, he also thinks Dorne will throw their lot with fake Aegon, and blood will flow much blood before this stupid farce is over. I'm not surprised he has that view because he doesn't like the Blackfish, for example. Like, he's going from a very commoner point of view, like what's the effect on the commoners with these like noble bloodlusts or these kind of like honor till the last fight sort of thing. But and I talked about that in my essay. Dorne is a gray place and the characters are gray. The legendary Dornish temper has been referred to in songs and that sort of thing, and that could cause trouble. Like the lust for revenge can cause trouble, and it may cause trouble for them. They have vices and they have the virtues, and so that's why it's, you know, it's a complex place. It's not like everything is great down there. I think there will be a lot of blood.
That was the point of Stefan's whole essay, actually, for the collector's edition. So It's interesting how your two essays really kind of complement one another.
Though, you know, I have to wonder, I mean, obviously we haven't had really any much exposure to the Dornish small folk, but we have had a little bit. I mean, there was a lot of unrest in Sunspear when the Red Viper was killed, and since the Dornish as a people, even the small folk, I think, pride their cultural difference and their independence so fiercely, this might actually be a case where at least some of the small folk don't mind so much being caught up in Dorne's revenge trip, because I think there's a strong thirst for that even outside of the nobility. What would your thoughts on that be?
Yeah, I totally agree. Like, in fact, Doran is being, and he's being like blamed for it as being the calming influence here, keeping things in control. And he, like, unlike some other lords, like, yeah, he wants his revenge, but he cares about his people and doesn't want them to lose. He only wants to make his move when it's 100% win. So, and he's thinking about the consequences for his people, but like, and he even mentions that, like, I think to Arya Hota, I think he mentions, like, he says, like, no Dornish man other than my brother has died. Is that like my shame, or is that something to be proud of? But I think Stefan would say that's something to be proud of, because he's kept him out of the war. And if you're going to make a move, like, make it at the point at the end game and have a high probability of success and the least amount of bloodshed. Like, so far it's worked. Like, if they'd gone with Renly or something, they would probably lost half the army somewhere. Like, it made sense to just stay there, bunker down, and wait for the end game. And like the Vale of Arryn, they're conserving their forces and they're doing their harvest and that sort of thing. Although, I mean, like, the weather down there, we don't know how that's going to be affected by winter. But even though he has that lust for revenge, he's actually being very careful and he's considering the consequences for Dorne as well.
Sure.
I think once the collector's edition comes out and once it goes off sale on November 1st, we should geek out for much, much longer about all these issues and how they interrelate.
And we're planning to have Miles on at some point so we can go over like his rebuttal to Alex, or have them both on, and then they can duke it out. They can have a duel. So,
Alex, were you offended by his essay at all?
No, I was not offended at all.
Good.
I, you know, as I said before, I mean, it really is an issue that can go either way. I do disagree with some of his points. He seems to think that having the Dothraki be part of it wasn't really such a bad idea, because he said that he thinks that militarily it could work. And as I said, I think in a best case scenario, militarily it could work. I just don't think politically, socially, economically, I don't think it works in any other way, and so I strongly disagree with him there. But some of the other points he brings up are definitely things that can go either way. I mean, certainly one big elephant in the room is Varys's last conversation with Kevin in the epilogue of A Dance with Dragons. I mean, he has no reason to lie there about who Aegon is. And I find it and obviously since Varys would have been involved in the switcheroo, I mean, it's not something Illyrio could have been keeping a secret from him. I mean, I suppose you could have a real crackpot theory where, you know, Varys did the switch and then Illyrio killed the baby and substituted his own son. But that's getting way, way, way too far into left field, I think. I mean, I'm not going there. And so that is certainly a big point against it. And that's a good point that I briefly mentioned that in my own essay, and then Miles also mentions it in his. And I think a couple of his other points are also very good, because at this point, we could go either way. And I think it's great to have that discussion and that counterpoint within the book, because it's, you know, one of the advantages of doing this collector's edition is there's a chance for a little dialogue and reflection on our own work. And I think it's great that, you know, some of the follow-up essays are actually complementing stuff that's already been said or standing in opposition to it, because that just makes the whole Flight of Sorrows experience a richer one, in my opinion.
Okay, so Mark, we'll have the websites up on our site for October 1st, but is there like a Facebook or something people can go to right now?
There is a Flight of Sorrows on Facebook that the two of us tend to occasionally hover over and update. I've been rather sick this week, so I've been kind of hit or miss with all the updates, but I have been posting some pictures and some quotes from a collector's edition, and I think I'll keep on doing it since it'll only be available for 1 month, and I want people to get access to certain little choice nuggets. So yeah, check that out, definitely.
So was there a contest for the back cover? Like, is that done yet, or is this resolved? Like, what happened?
Oh yeah, that's over. We have a winner. I have a guy doing the cover right now. That's going to be revealed this coming week. All the different people involved in the collector's edition will be revealed this week. We're going to have a couple, like two or three, maybe even four different announcements with the ebook. We're changing the price. We're going to different venues. We're going to be doing a whole bunch of crazy stuff with it. So there'll be lots of really cool press releases all week long.
And is this, you mean a hymn for spring? Like the next one? Is that what you mean?
No, I mean for Flight of Sorrows ebook. We're still going to be changing that up.
Excellent. All right, I guess I'll wrap us up. Thanks for listening, everybody. You can check out our podcast, podcastoficeandfire.com, and we're on Twitter, on Tumblr, and DeviantArt. And thank you for joining me, you guys. It's been great chatting with you, too.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, see you all next time.
I have no children either. I was just that was a You're sympathy. Children, that was a sympathy play.
that you know of, Alex. You always have to say
that is true. Okay. That is true.
Hey.
Hello. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
You got your headset? Me. Okay. Good. Perfect.
Hold on 1 second. I'm trying to cat wrangle.
that never ends well.
It's kind of like editing. All right. I also have a crying 1-year-old
like
in the background.
Cats or something. So.
Yeah. Can you really hear me? Okay.
Yeah.
No in the background.
More, but now it's better.
I'm sorry, guys. I'm getting over a cold, so bear with me.
But yeah, I'm just gonna see if anybody else is coming, just to double check here. I don't think anyone could make it today. No, I think we're good to go. Let's do the three of us. Are we good? You know each other, right? Like, now you realize who each other.
Well, I mean, we know each other through email and through collaboration, but this is the first time we have ever spoken directly in my memory.
Yeah, it is. It's got me all quiver.
The podcast, as far as big networking place, everybody meets here. It's the hub.
Yeah, well, you know, we're all, well, I can't speak for everybody, but, you know, I'm one of those isolationist nerds, I guess. So this gets us all out and talking.
Okay, episode 120. Yeah, can you hear a piano in the background? Bede, probably.
Hear a piano?
Yeah.
No, oh, I can't.
Okay.
Are you sure you're not having a stroke? I hear that can happen.
No, there is a piano in the background. This
okay.
Let's see. Episode 120. Week of 20 seconds. Okay. You ready? Okay, here we go.
Sure.
Yep.